Chapter 9. 10 minutes later, I was humming under my breath and watching the gathering in Murphy's living room. Sir Stuart stood beside me, his expression interested, curious.
"I beg pardon, wizard," he said, "but what is that tune you're trying to sing?"
I belted out the opening trumpet fanfare of the main theme and then said in a deep and cheesy announcer's voice,
"In the Great Hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's 4 greatest heroes created from the cosmic legends of the universe."
Sir Stuart frowned at me.
"Created from
the cosmic legends of the universe," I repeated in the same voice.
Sir Stuart narrowed his eyes and turned slightly away from me, his shoulders tight.
"That makes no sense. None at all."
"It did on Saturday mornings in the 70s, apparently," I said. I nodded at the room beyond the window, and we've got something similar going on here. Though for a hall of the Justice League, it looks pretty small. Real estate wasn't as expensive back then, I guess.
"The guests assembled inside," Sir Stuart asked. "Do you know them?"
"Most of them," I said. Then I felt obliged to add, "or at least I knew them 6 months ago." Things had changed. Murphy's buzz cut was just a start. I started introducing Sir Stuart to the faces I knew. Will Borden leaned against one wall, slightly behind Murphy, his muscular arms folded. He was a man of below average height and well above average build. All of it was muscle. I was used to seeing him mostly in after-work business casual clothing, whenever he wasn't transformed into a huge dark wolf, I mean. Today, he was wearing sweats and a loose top, the better for getting out of in a hurry if he wanted to change. Generally a quiet, reliable, intelligent man, Will was the leader of a local band of college kids, now all grown up, who had learned to take on the shape of wolves. They'd called themselves the Alphas for so long that the name had stopped sounding silly in my own head when I thought it. I wasn't used to seeing Will playing the heavy, but he was clearly in that role. His expression was locked into something just shy of a scowl, and his dark eyes positively smoldered with pent-up aggression. He looked like a man who wanted a fight, and who would gladly jump on the first opportunity to get into one. On the couch, not far from Will, the other Alpha present was curled up into a ball in the corner, her legs up to her chest. She had straight hair the color of a mouse's fur that hung to her chin and an even sheet all the way around, and she looked as if a strong breeze might knock her to the floor. She peered owlishly out through a pair of large eyeglasses and a curtain of hair, and I got the impression that she saw the whole room at the same time. I hadn't seen her in several years, but she'd been one of the original Alphas and had gotten her degree and toddled off into the vanilla world. Her name was... Marcy, right. Her name was Marcy. Next to Marcy sat a plump, cheerful-looking woman with blonde, curly hair held sloppily in place with a couple of chopsticks, who looked a couple of years shy of qualifying to be a television grandmother. She wore a floral print dress, and on her lap she held a dog the approximate size of a bratwurst, a Yorkshire Terrier. The dog was clearly on alert, his bright dark eyes moving from person to person around the room, but focused mostly on Marcy. He was growling deep in his chest and obviously ready to defend his owner at an instant's notice.
"Abby," I told Sir Stuart. "Her name's Abby. The dog is Toto. She survived a white court vampire who was hunting down her social circle. Small-time practitioners." The little dog abruptly sprang out of Abby's arms to throw itself toward Will, but the woman moved in remarkably quick reaction and caught Toto. Except it hadn't been remarkably quick. It had simply begun a half second before the little dog had jumped. Abby was a prescient. She couldn't see far into the future, only a few seconds, but that was enough talent to make me bet there weren't many broken dishes in her kitchen. Will looked at Toto as the little dog jumped and smiled. Abby shushed the Yorkie and frowned at Will before turning to the table to pick up a cup of tea in one hand, still holding the dog with the other. Next to Abby was a brawny young man in jeans, work boots, and a heavy flannel shirt.
He had dark, untidy hair and intense gray eyes, and I could have opened a bottle cap with a dimple in his chin. It took me a second to recognize him, because he'd been a couple of inches shorter and maybe 40 pounds lighter the last time I'd seen him. Daniel Carpenter, the eldest of my apprentice's younger brothers. He looked as though he were seated on a hot stove rather than a comfortable couch, like he might bounce up at any second boldly to do something ill-conceived. A large part of Will's attention was, I thought, focused on Daniel. "Relax," Murphy told him. "Have some cake." Daniel shook his head in a jerky negative. "No, thank you, Miss Murphy," he said. "I just don't see the point in this. I should go find Molly. If I leave right now, I can be back before an hour's up." "If Molly isn't here, we'll assume it's because she has a good reason for it," Murphy said, her tone calm and utterly implacable. "There's no sense in running all over town on a night like this."
"Besides," Will drawled, "we'd find her faster."
Daniel scowled from beneath his dark hair for a second, but quickly looked away. It gave me the sense that he'd run afoul of Will before and hadn't liked the outcome. The younger man kept his mouth shut. An older man sat in the chair beside the couch, and he took the opportunity to lean over the table and pour hot tea from a china teapot into the cup in front of the young carpenter. He added a lump of sugar to it and smiled at Daniel. There was nothing hostile, impatient, or demanding in his eyes, which were the color of a robin's eggs. Only complete certainty that the younger man would accept the tea and settle down. Daniel eyed the man, then dropped his eyes to the square of white cellulose at his collar and the crucifix hanging beneath it. He took a deep breath, then nodded and stirred his tea. He took the cup in both hands and settled back to wait. After a sip, he appeared to forget he was holding it, but he stayed quiet.
"And you, Miss Murphy?" asked Father Fordhill, holding up the teapot. "It's a cold night. I'm sure a cup would do you good."
"Why not?" she said. Fordhill filled another cup for Murphy, took it to her, and pulled at his sweater vest as if trying to coax more warmth from the garment. He turned and walked over to the window where Sir Stuart and I stood and held out both hands.
"Are you sure there isn't a draft? I could swear I feel it."
I blinked and eyed Sir Stuart, who shrugged and said,
"He's one of the good ones."
"Good what?"
"Ministers, priests, shamans, whatever."
His expression seemed to be carefully neutral.
"You spend your life caring for the souls of others, you get a real sense of them."
Sir Stuart nodded at Father Fordhill.
"Ghosts like us aren't souls as such, but we aren't much different. He feels us, even if he isn't fully aware of it."
Toto escaped Abby's lap and came scrambling over the hardwood floor to put his paws up on the walls beneath the windows. He yapped ferociously several times, staring right at me.
"And dogs," Sir Stuart added. "Maybe 1 in 10 of them seem to have a talent for sensing us. Probably why they're always barking."
"What about cats?" I asked. Mister had fled the living room upon the arrival of other people and wasn't in sight.
"Of course, cats,"
Sir Stuart said, his voice faintly amused.
"As far as I could tell, all cats. But they aren't terribly impressed with the fact that we're dead and still present. One rarely gets a reaction from them."
Father Fordhill gently scooped Toto from the floor. The little dog wiggled energetically, tail flailing in the air, and kissed Forthill's hand soundly before the old priest passed him carefully back to Abby, smiling and nodding to her before refilling his own cup of tea and sitting down again.
"Who are they waiting on?" Sir Stuart asked. "This Molly person?"
"Maybe," I said. There was one more chair in the room. It was closest to the door and farthest from every other piece of furniture in the room. Practically every other seat in the room would have a clear line of fire to the last chair if it came to shooting. Maybe that was a coincidence, but I don't think so. There was a quick chirping sound, and Murphy picked up a radio smaller than a deck of cards.
"Murphy, go."
"Ricemobile imminent," said a quiet voice. "Furry Knockers is running a sweep." Will blew out a sudden snort of amused breath. Murphy smiled and shook her head before she spoke into the radio.
"Thanks, Eyes. Pull in as soon as she's done. Hot tea for you." Weather's just crazy, right? Only in Chicago. Eyes out. This is just so wrong, said Daniel, as Murphy put the radio away. That's a terrible radio handle. It could cause mixed messages in a tactical situation.
Murphy arched an eyebrow and spoke in a dry tone. I'm trying to imagine the situation in which someone mistakenly being told to be alert for the enemy ends in disaster.
If someone on the team was juggling glass vials of a deadly virus, Will supplied promptly, or nitroglycerin.
Murphy nodded. Make a note, discontinue use of radio in the event of a necessary nitroviro juggling mission.
Noted, Will drawled.
Daniel stiffened. You've got a big mouth, Mr. Borden. Will never moved.
It's not my mouth, kid. It's your skin. It's too thin.
Daniel narrowed his eyes, but Fort Hill put a hand on the brawny youth's shoulder. The old man couldn't possibly restrain Daniel physically, but his touch might as well have been a steel chain attached to a battleship's anchor. His move to rise became an adjustment of himself in his seat, and he folded his arms, scowling.
Pasty face in 5, 4, 3, came from Murphy's radio.
Backs tightened. Faces became masks. Several hands vanished from sight. Someone's teacup clinked several times in rapid succession against a saucer before it settled. I could see the front door from where I stood outside the window, and a couple of seconds after the radio stopped counting aloud, it opened upon a white court vampire. She was maybe 5'2", with a dimpled smile and dark, curly hair that fell to her waist. She was wearing a white blouse with a long, full white skirt and bright scarlet ballet slippers. The first thought that went through my head was, oh, she's tiny and adorable, followed closely by the notion that she would be fastidious when blood was everywhere. I could just see her carefully lifting the hem of her pristine skirt so that only the scarlet slippers would touch it.
Good evening, everyone, she said, breezing through the door without an invitation, speaking with a strong British accent. I apologize for being a few moments late, but what's a lady to do with weather like this? Tea? Lovely.
She minced over to the table and poured some hot tea into an empty cup. Her eyes fastened on Daniel as she did, and she bowed just low enough to draw the young man's eyes to her décolletage. He flushed and looked away sternly after a second. Tough to blame the kid. I'd been a young man. Boobs are near the center of the universe until you turn 25 or so, which is also when young men's auto insurance rates go down. This is not a coincidence. The vampire smirked, a surprisingly predatory expression on her Cupid's bow lips, and glided back to the empty chair by the door, seating herself in it like Shirley Temple on a movie set, sure that she held the attention of everyone there. Gutsy, I said quietly.
Why do you say that?
Sir Stuart asked. She came in without an invitation, I said.
I thought vampires couldn't do that.
The Reds they couldn't without being half paralyzed. The Black Court vampires can't cross a threshold period. The whites can, but it cripples their abilities, makes it very difficult to draw on their hunger for strength and speed. Sir Stuart shook his head.
Ah, yes. She's a succubus.
Well, not exactly, but the differences are academic. The shade nodded.
I'm not exposing Mortimer to that creature.
Probably not a bad idea, I agreed. He's got access to way too much information. They'd love to get someone like Mort under their thumb. Hello, Felicia, Murphy said, her tone cool and professional. All right, people. Mr. Childs won't be here tonight. I'm holding his proxy. Felicia curled the fingers of both tiny hands around the teacup and sipped it. The tea had been scalding when the others had first sipped it. They'd been cautious. The vampire took a mouthful as if it had been room-temperature Kool-Aid and swallowed it down with a little shiver of apparent pleasure.
How convenient for you. Shall we ever see the dapper gentleman again?
That will be up to Marcone, Murphy replied. Abby? Toto was staring at Felicia and standing with stiff legs on Abby's lap. If he'd been capable of a threatening growl, he'd have been doing it. Instead, there was just a steady squeaking sound coming from his general direction. Abby took a firmer grip on Toto and looked down at a notebook in her lap.
The Paranet continues to operate at better than 75% of its original capacity. We actually regained contact with Minnesota, Massachusetts, and Alabama this week. She cleared her throat and blinked her eyes several times.
We lost contact with Washington.
Seattle or Tacoma? Murphy asked.
Yes, Abby said quietly. No one has heard from a member in either place for the past 3 days.
Fort Hill crossed himself and said something beneath his breath.
Amen, Father,
Felicia murmured.
Someone got their roster, Daniel said, his voice harsh.
Will grunted and nodded.
Do we know who?
Abby said, giving Will a brief, apologetic smile. We haven't heard from anyone, so no, we'll have to send someone to investigate.
Murphy said, shaking her head. No, if that many people have been taken, it means one of the larger powers is at work. If the Fomor have come to Washington in strength, we'd just be throwing our scout into a snake pit.
If we move quickly enough, Abby disagreed firmly, we might be able to save some of them.
Murphy's expression turned introspective. True, but there's nothing we can do from here. She looked at Fort Hill.
I'll find out what I can through our channels, he promised. But I fear you will find little in the way of remedy there.
Murphy nodded. We'll kick this one up to the wardens. Daniel snorted at exactly the same time I did.
Oh, sure. The White Council, the young man said. They're the answer to this, because they care so much about the little guy in the immediate future. They'll wander in right away, a mere year or two from now.
Will gave Daniel a flat look, and the muscles along his jaw twitched. Murphy lifted a hand and said, I'll call Ramirez and ask him to expedite. I'll ask Elaine Mallory to back me up. Elaine Mallory. When Murphy said it, the name cracked something in my head and a geyser of memories erupted from it. Elaine had been my first friend, first crush, first lover, first victim, or so I had believed for years at any rate. She somehow escaped the flames that consumed my old mentor, Justin Dumourne. About a million sense memories hit me all at once. It was like trying to watch a warehouse wall lined with televisions, all of them on different stations, all of them blaring at maximum volume. Sunshine on skin, smooth curve of slender waist and leanly muscled back as Elaine dove into a moonlit swimming pool. The blindingly gentle sensation of our first kiss, slow and tentative and careful as it had been. Elaine, who had been subverted into Justin's slave, who hadn't been strong enough to defend herself when Justin came to claim her mind, who I failed to protect. Joy and pain came with those memories. It was deliriously intense, as disorienting and overwhelming as any drug.
Hell's bells, I hate being the new guy.
I managed to push the memories off after a few moments, in time to hear the vampire speak. Felicia cleared her throat and lifted a hand.
As it happens, she said, I know that we have some assets in the area. It's possible they might be able to find something.
It's also possible that they're responsible for the disappearances, Marcy said mildly.
Nonsense, child, Felicia responded with a little toss of her head. We hardly need to capture our prey and corral them where their thick numbers will make hunting simple.
She gave Marcy a sweetly dimpled smile.
We already have such pens. They're called cities.
We will be happy for any information the White Court is willing to provide, Felicia, Murphy said, her calm, professional, neutral tone expertly dulling the edges of the previous words. What about Chicago, Abby?
We lost two this week, Abby said. Nathan Simpson and Sunbeam Munro.
A ghoul took Simpson. Will supplied at once. We settled his account.
Murphy glanced at Will in approval. Have I met Sunbeam?
Abby nodded. The college student from San Jose.
Murphy winced. Right. Tall girl, hippie-esque parents.
That's her. She was accompanied to the L station, and someone was waiting at her destination. She never arrived.
Murphy made a growling sound that more than made up for Toto's lack. We know anything? Will looked at Marcy. The stringy girl shook her head.
The snow is holding too many scents in place. I couldn't find anything solid.
She looked down at her knees and added,
sorry.
Murphy ignored that last bit. She shouldn't have been traveling alone. We're going to have to stress the importance of partnering up.
How? Abby asked. I mean, it's in every circular.
Murphy nodded. Will? Will drummed his fingertips on his biceps and nodded. I'll see to it.
Thank you.
Abby blinked several times and then said,
Karen, you can't possibly mean...
People are dying, Murphy said simply. A good scare can do wonders to cure stupidity. Or we could try protecting them, said Daniel. Fort Hill lifted a hand again, but the younger man ignored him, rising to his feet. Daniel's voice was a rich, strong baritone. All over the world, dark things are rising up against mortals connected to the supernatural, killing them or dragging them away into the dark. Creatures that haven't been seen by mankind in the past 2 millennia are reappearing, fighting mortals, fighting one another. The shadows are boiling over with death and terror, and no one is doing anything about it. The wardens went from fighting the vampire war to a new one, against an enemy without a face or an identity. The White Council doesn't have wardens enough to handle everything that's happening anyway. If a cry for help is sent up anywhere but a major city, there's no chance at all of them showing up. Meanwhile, what are we doing? Daniel's voice filled with quiet scorn. Telling people to travel around in herds, scaring them ourselves to make them do so, as if there wasn't terror enough in the world already. Murphy stared steadily at him. Then she said, her tone hard, "That's enough." Daniel ignored her, planting his feet and squaring his shoulders. You know what must be done, Miss Murphy. You're holding 2 of the greatest weapons against darkness that the world has ever known. Bring forth the swords!" A dead silence settled on the room, into which Sir Stuart asked me, conversationally, "Which swords?" "The swords of the cross," I said, quietly out of habit. I could have sung it operatically without anyone there noticing. The ones with the nails from the crucifixion worked into them.
Excalibur, Durandal, and Kusanagi.
Yes, yes, Sir Stuart said, his tone a little impatient. Of course I know the swords of the cross. And the little blonde woman has 2 of them. I just stared at the burly shade for a long second. I'd found what amounted to a rumor that Amorakius was in fact the same sword given to King Arthur, but I hadn't ever heard anything about the other 2, despite some fairly exhaustive research over the years. The shade had dropped their identities as if they were everyday knowledge. Sir Stuart frowned at me and said, "What is it? Do you know how much research I..." I blew out an exasperated breath, scowled, and said, "I went to public school." Back inside, Murphy didn't break the silence. She just stared at Daniel for maybe 2 minutes. Then she directed a rather pointed glance at Felicia and eyed Daniel again. The young man glanced at Felicia and closed his eyes as his cheeks got redder and his passion swiftly deflated. He muttered something under his breath and sat down again rather quickly. The vampire sat in her chair, staring at Daniel over the rim of her teacup and smiling as if butter wouldn't melt in her mouth. For all I knew, it wouldn't. "I love young men," she purred. "I just love them." "Mr. Carpenter," Murphy said, "I assume you have divulged secrets enough to the enemies of humanity for one evening?" Daniel said nothing. "Then perhaps you can join Eyes and Fuzz in keeping watch outside." He rose at once, slipping into his heavy fleece-lined blue denim coat. It was an old, well-used garment. I'd seen his father wearing it, but it was a little big on Daniel. Without a word, he left the living room for the kitchen and went out the back door. Silence was heavy when he left.
"Both sorts," Felicia said, her tone light, her periwinkle eyes on Murphy. "My, my, my." She sipped at her tea and said, "Of course you'll have to kill me, dear, if you can." The diminutive vampire looked casually at each person in the room. "I give you one chance in four."
"I can't let the White Court know about the swords," Murphy agreed. Her fingers hung near the handle of her gun. Will watched with sleepy eyes, but sometime in the past few seconds he had managed to center his weight over his feet. Marcy still crouched with her legs curled up to the rest of her, but they were under her dress now. Within a heartbeat, she could have it off and clear it from impeding her shape-shifting. Felicia was in exactly the same posture as several minutes before. She looked entirely unconcerned with any possible danger. I made a mental note never to play poker with her.
"Well, darling, if you intended to dance, there would already be music, so perhaps we should talk."
She smiled, and her eyes glittered, suddenly several shades lighter than before.
"Just us girls. We can go for a walk."
Murphy snorted. She drew her gun from her belt and set it on the armrest of her chair. She rested her hand over it, not quite touching the trigger. "I'm not an idiot, Felicia. You'll stay right where you are. As will I. Everyone else, outside." Abby had risen before Murphy finished speaking, holding Toto carefully as she left. Will frowned at Murphy. "You sure?" Father Forthill rose, frowning, and said,
"These old legs. Want to go for a little walk in any case? Good evening, Miss Murphy. William?"
Will literally growled, and it came out sounding like no noise a human being ought to be able to make. But then he nodded to Murphy and turned toward the door. Marcy hurried to her feet and went after him. Forthill stumped off after them. I heard everyone leave the house by the back door, probably to gather on the stone-paved patio just outside.
"I like this," Felicia said into the silence, smiling. "This charming little house feels so intimate, don't you think?"
She tilted her head.
"Are the swords on the premises?"
"I think you should name your price," Murphy responded. Felicia arched an eyebrow, a sensual little smile bending one corner of her mouth into a smirk. Murphy cleared her throat. "Forget that. It isn't happening." The vampire turned her mouth down in a mocking little pout.
"Such a Puritan work ethic. Business and pleasure can coexist, you know."
"This isn't business, Ms. Wraith. It's blackmail."
"Tomato, tomato," Felicia said with a shrug. "The point is, Karen, that you can hardly afford to be squeamish."
"No?
No. You're intelligent, skilled, and strong-willed. Quite formidable," she smiled. "For a mortal. But in the end, you are a lone mortal, and you are no longer beneath the aegis of city law enforcement or resident members of the White Council."
Murphy moved nothing but her lips.
"Meaning?"
Felicia sighed and said in a practical, dispassionate tone, "The swords are valuable. They could be traded for a great deal of influence. Should the White Court learn of this and decide to take the swords, they will take you. They will ask you where they are. They will force you to surrender them." Murphy might have twitched one shoulder in a shrug. Then she got up and walked toward Felicia, gripping her gun loosely in hand.
"And what? If I give you what you want, you'll stay quiet?"
Felicia nodded, her eyelids lowering as she watched Murphy approach.
"For a few days, at any rate, by which time you will have been able to take measures to prevent them from being taken."
Murphy said, "You want to feed on me?"
Felicia ran a very pink tongue over her upper lip, her eyes growing paler.
"I do, very much."
Murphy frowned and nodded. Then she whipped the pistol in a bone-breaking stroke, smashing it into the vampire's jaw.
"Yes," I hissed, clenching my hands into fists.
The vampire let out a short, stunned, gasping sound and rocked beneath the blow. She slid out of the chair to her knees, feebly trying to move away from Murphy. Murph wasn't having any of it. She grabbed Felicia by the hair, hauled her halfway to her feet, and then, with a furious shout and a contraction of her whole body, Murphy slammed the vampire's face down onto the coffee table. Felicia's head shattered the teapot and the platter beneath, and struck the oak table with such force that a crack erupted from end to end in the wood. Murph slammed Felicia's head down with near equal violence two more times. Then she turned and dragged Felicia over to the front door of her house by the hair. Murphy let her go with a contemptuous shove, stood over her, and pointed a gun at the vampire's head. "This is what happens," Murphy said in a very quiet, hard voice. "You leave here alive. You keep your fucking mouth shut. And we never mention tonight ever again. If the White Court even blinks in the sword's direction, I am going to come find you, Felicia. Whatever happens to me in the end, before I am taken, I will find you." Felicia stared up at her, wobbling and shaking, clearly dazed. Murphy had broken the vampire's nose and knocked out at least two teeth. One of Felicia's high cheekbones was already swelling. The broken teapot had left multiple cuts on her face, and her skin had been scalded by the hot liquid still inside. Murphy leaned a little closer and put the barrel of the gun against Felicia's forehead. Then she whispered very quietly, "Bang." The vampire shuddered. "Do what you think best, Felicia," Murph whispered. Then she straightened again slowly and spoke in a clear, calm voice as she walked back to her chair. "Now, get out of my house." Felicia managed to stagger to her feet, open the front door, and limp haltingly to the white limousine idling on the snowy street outside the house. Murphy went to the window to watch Felicia get into the limo and depart. "Yeah," I said, deadpan. "The little blonde woman has two of them."
"Oh, my,"
Sir Stuart said, his voice muted with respect.
"I can see why you'd come to her for assistance."
"Damn skippy," I agreed. "Better go get Morty while she's still in a good mood."